be talking about concepts of sadness in the Quran. For those who haven't been here for any of our programs prior to Iftar, what we've been doing is building out a curriculum that essentially focuses every night on some aspect of the Quran, enabling us to be able to engage it and deepen our relationship with it. We've been going through different stories that we find in the Quran, talking about elements of kind of civic and social engagement. For example, last night, Sheikh Saheb Webb did a program on environmental justice through the Quran. We've looked at particular historical figures and what we could draw in terms of meaning from, you know, their stories that are accounted in the Quran. The idea is for us to start to really engage it at a deeper level. And so today we're going to look at it through the prism of what our tradition says about the concept of sadness. Beforehand, what I wanted to do really quickly was just give you all an opportunity to really introduce yourselves to one another, the people who are sitting around you. Part of our discussion is going to be interactive, kind of broken into groups, as we've done before. So you can take a minute, and just the people who are sitting around you in close proximity, introduce yourselves to them, tell them your name, how's your Ramadan going, a little bit about yourself before we get started, inshallah. If you already know the people sitting around you, it makes it easier. If you find somebody you don't know, that'd be really great as well. So, I think as a starting point to this discussion, what we want to understand is really how we relate to this concept of sadness. And I said this in one of the last halakhas that I led here, and you might have heard me say it in other programs or events, but, you know, for us, I think in general, we don't necessarily always have a deep relationship with terms, words, language that have to deal with emotional states as we do with other things that perhaps have more concrete meaning that we, across the board, could relate to in our day-to-day interactions, right? In the Quran, for example, we have in the second chapter, it's called Surah Al-Baqarah, narrative around the Adamic creation story. And when the Prophet Adam, peace be upon him, is created, one of the verses that describes what that looks like after the fact, it says, وَعَلَّمَ آدَمَ الْأَسْمَاءَ كُلَّهَا, that, you know, essentially, Adam was taught the names of everything. But a parameter through which we are given distinction as humans in comparison to the rest of creation is that we have language at our disposal. And language in and of itself becomes the means through which we can deepen consciousness, arguably. Right? Like, I have a 3-year-old, his name's Kareem, I have a 6-year-old named Medina, and Medina's language skills are probably a little bit ahead of Kareem's because she's 3 years older, and every year when they have been alive, their ability to engage has deepened that much from the time they were born until now she's 6, because they're increasing in their communication skills. So a child is only able to express through tears, and a parent is somewhat frustrated, not just because they might not know what's going on, but if you ever had a baby, everybody around you likes to tell you why your baby's crying, and most of the time they're wrong, and you want to tell them to shut up because they don't know what they're talking about. But the child can only communicate through that one mode of expression because they don't have access to be able to, at some point, move their hands, literally, or move their legs, or to give gestures or innuendos. And then, as they start to pick up language, there's now a distinction in emotions that are expressed, but they still don't have all of the words. Does that make sense? Like, when my daughter was 2 or 3, we went to Washington, D.C., and we were at one of my friend's houses, and he thought it would be funny to teach her words that were actually not the names of things. So I went out into his backyard, and my daughter was pointing at a tree and calling it a duck. And she kept saying, duck, duck, duck. And I said, did you teach my child that a tree is called a duck? And he said, yes, I did. And I said, thanks, wait till you have a baby and see what happens. If you don't know the name of something, you likely don't necessarily also know it to its deeper level, right? And for a lot of us, we learn language in a way that's experiential, or we learn concepts in a way that might be curricular, but how we engage emotions experientially is definitely not on a curricular structured level, and in the manner in which we engage it quite often, it's usually at a very surface level. So if we were to pick any term that we would name, even in the space around us, if I say floor, if I say carpet, if I say camera, if I say man, I say sun, you know what those things are without us having to give a deeper context to it, right? So we don't say when we talk about, a camera, that the mechanical apparatus that is utilized to capture moments via photography and video that needs to be charged through cellular batteries, you just call it a camera. And everybody knows what a camera is, right? But if I say the word love to you, would it mean the same thing to everyone in the room? Or if I said the word mercy, or compassion, hope, justice, character, beauty, integrity, honesty, or if I said a word like sadness, do you think all of us would know the meaning of that word, or it would resonate with a comprehension the same way if I said camera to you, every one of us would likely be able to understand what the camera was? Do you get what I'm saying? So somebody taught you that 2 + 2 = 4. Somebody taught you the sky is blue. If somebody didn't teach you what sadness is, nor did they teach you, likely in turn, how to respond to it, how to identify it, how to know when someone actually is it, what are ways to cope with it, what are the benefits of it, what are consequently maybe some of the difficulties that arise from it. And then the inability to be able to label it accurately, stemming from a low capacity in being able to know how to discriminate emotions and categorize them for what they actually are, quite often then renders like a mislabeling, not just of the other, but of ourselves. So if my son only knows a limited amount of words, he's going to just use those same words over and over and over. Right? He had a sticker in his hand the other day that had a picture of an eye on it, and it said Oculus. And so he said, Baba, what's Oculus? And I said, Kareem, do you know what ocular means? And he's 3, and he looked at me and was like, no. so I told him what ocular means. And we talked about it and how it relates to the eye and what an eye does and all these kinds of things. And now my 3-year-old has the word ocular in his vocab. He likely won't use it correctly for quite some time, if ever, because when was the last time in daily jargon you utilized the word ocular? But how he will become accustomed and acquainted to utilizing it is going to stem from the mistakes that he makes when he uses it, or his willingness to have the courage to engage it, and to adapt in his conversation the utilization of terms that are beyond just what he has day-to-day access to, right? Like my daughter and I were walking down the street the other day, and she was dressed as a unicorn, and I was taking her to a birthday party before I caught a plane to fly across the country, or fly to DC and then go across the country. And so the birthday party she was going to was at California Pizza Kitchen, and she had a unicorn headband on, and she had a bag that had a unicorn on it. And I said, "What kind of unicorn are you?" And she and I went back and forth. And I said, "Can you fly?" And she said, "No, Baba. If I could fly, I would be a Pegasus." And I said, "Why do you know the word Pegasus?" And we then talked about that. But she knows it. And because she knows it, she knows how to relate it to an actual deepening of a description. You understand? Sadness is one of 7 foundational emotions that we experience in our day-to-day existence. And it has meaning to it that doesn't necessarily have to be as concrete as camera or floor or chair, but it still has meaning to it. What do you think sadness means if we were to give it a description or definition? Not happy. Great. What else?
Unwellness.
Okay.
Pain.
I make up words all the time, so feel free to make up words. Pain, stress. What else? Anything else? Great. There's probably like dozens of more things. When does sadness usually happen?
When you lose something.
When you have a loss. Okay. What else?
When something doesn't go your way.
Disappointment.
When something unexpected happens.
Great. So, if we were to start to break this down, everything that you're saying seems to be kind of consequential, right? It's not a default state of existence, but you experience loss, something unexpected, failure, etc., right? These are the aftermath of something. They're not kind of the consistent state. Do you know what I mean? I can wake up sad, I can go to bed sad, right? And may Allah make us from amongst those who have contentment. I can be in a place where I feel sad, but as we're starting to narrow down a definition, we want to be able to really understand how it factors into our day-to-day, right? Because sadness is not just a sad face, but sadness is an actual state attached to an emotion. And the entrance into a state necessitates what that catalyst is that brings it about, so to speak, right? Like, you don't necessarily need a reason to be happy, but you need a reason to be sad, more or less. Does that make sense, right? Which is different from depression. So depression, for example, renders, like, some of this But not necessarily because it's the consequence of an action, right? It's not that X happens and then it yields Y, and Y we can identify as one of these things. But we're just saying in depression that Y is happening. And X didn't necessarily bring it about, it's just there. Do you see the difference? Yeah? What kind of things can make somebody sad? Or better, right? Before we go there. For us now, looking at this through the prism of Islam as a tradition, looking at the Quran as a text, this type of sadness is affiliated with an Arabic word that has the root ha, za, and nun, huzn. And when you look within texts that make commentary on the Quran, you look at commentaries on the prophetic tradition, because the Prophet Muhammad, alayhi salam, he makes dua to Allah, saying that, oh Allah, protect me from this kind of sadness, this huzn, right? He says, hammi wal huzn. That's what he's seeking refuge from. And we have within the Quran a lot that's written that gives us indication onto human condition. And what we have to understand is that this aspect of emotions is not necessarily something that is rooted in modernity, nor is it something that is limited to a pre-modern context, but there's a universal sense of how emotions factor into the Quranic framework of existence, the philosophy of life that is Islam, because our religion sees us through multiple facets, right? We're not just the body that we have, the jasad, the badan. We're not just the hearts that we have, the qalb. We're not just the ego, the nafs. We're not just our sheer will and determination, irada. We're not just our intellectual capacity to discern right from wrong within the divine prism of morality, right? What our aqal is. You're all of those things, and you're so much more. Distinct from where we are today on conversations that exist within the Muslim community, in large part, and it's a generalization that I'm comfortable making, that's quite distinct from what our heritage actually is. So if we were to compare, for example, at a time within the European framework, when Christendom is literally burning people alive at the stake, and this is not a knock on anybody, but we learn this if you ever study European history, right? And where people are dealing and wrestling with emotional wellness, mental wellness, states attached to those parts of themselves, and the response in that part of the world is to say that there's something demonic at play. We must kill these people, literally. That's what happens in the Dark Ages, right? Comparatively, in the Muslim community, what you find is the establishment and development of interdisciplinary groups that are bringing together the religious scholar, the doctor, the social worker, the mental health professional to build apparatus that utilizes zakah, our obligatory charity as a revenue stream, to now create the social service that has everybody offer their expertise, and then after the fact, the individual is given a stipend to be able to get back on their feet. And you can look at classical texts of Islam that talk about this word, huzn, right? And the letters are separate, just so we can see them. But you can put them together, and that's the word, huzn. And people like Imam al-Razi, people like Imam al-Tabari, people like Imam al-Ghazali, people who are digging deep into what words mean in the Quran for us to draw depth from it, they're not saying that sadness is religiously impermissible, that depression is problematic, but they're saying and identifying huzn is when you experience the loss of something close to your heart, like a loved one, like an object that you have a deep attachment to, right? And we'll talk about it in a little bit, but that's actually one of the benefits of sadness. That if you experience sadness, that means you have real depth to relationships. That you're actually experiencing moments of real happiness and real elation and real contentment to the extent that when you feel separation from that thing, your heart starts to feel down. It gives you insight that there's something that you should be grateful for in your life, even if the way that you recognize it is by tasting its separation through this prism of sadness. But ours is not a religion that says that it does not exist, nor does it say that its manifestation is indicative of some deficiency or inadequacy in one's faith. Does it make sense? So like our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, on numerous instances, is shedding tears because he's sad. He has a son by the name of Ibrahim, who when he's once with his companion Abdurrahman ibn Auf, they are visiting Ibrahim as he takes his last breaths in this world. And when he passes away, the Prophet starts to shed tears. And he says, the eyes, they shed tears, and the heart, it trembles. That we will not question God's plan, but, O Ibrahim, your passing, it causes me grief. Abdurrahman ibn Auf, he says to the Prophet in response to the tears, Ya Rasulullah, O Messenger of God, what is this? And he says, O Ibn Auf, this is mercy. Or we have in the prophetic biography, following the 10th year of Revelation, a year that is identified by the historians of the prophetic biography, it's called the Amal al-Huzn, the year of sadness, the year of grief. Because in that year, the Prophet ﷺ loses his wife, Khadija radiallahu ta'ala anha, and his uncle Abu Talib. Khadija radiallahu ta'ala anha was there for her when nobody else was there for him. They had like a real love. It was very deep. The companions say that when she passes away, who the Prophet was before she passed away, he's not the same after she passes away. When Abu Talib passes away, this is a man who offers him not just protection in this Meccan society that is heavily based off of principles of lineage, and accountability is non-existent because theologically there's no understanding of a world after this one. And so who you were the child of, the clan that you came from, the amount of wealth that you had, definitely your skin color, your race, your class, it all factored into how people treated you and what you were protected from. So when Abu Talib passes away, who's in charge, and nobody can touch the Prophet because he's under his protection, Abu Lahab, he now takes control, and he could care less like what would happen to the Prophet of God. And people now have capacity to literally mock, ridicule, kill the Prophet without any type of impunity. Because they get to a place, or with impunity rather, because they get to a place where nobody's protecting him. And so it's not just that he experiences the loss of his wife and the loss of his uncle, but every time somebody now treats him in a way that he's never been treated before, right? You're a child who doesn't have a father or mother. You lost a loved one in your life. The kind of things that evoke memories of that person are not always positives, but also negative. Life is hard for the widow whose husband was the breadwinner, and every time she has to go and drive the taxi or the Uber and bring home very little in comparison to what she had before, and she has to purchase the food and give gifts on birthdays to children, and they react in a way that they remember what they had before, it all makes her remember that her husband's not there anymore. So every time a person of Quraysh drops the intestines of an animal on the Prophet's back when he's in prayer, or mocks him and ridicules him in front of his daughter, or literally chokes him, and his friends intercede. أَتُرِدُونَ يَبْتُرُونَ رَجُمًا يَقُولُ رَبِّيَ اللَّهُ, that are you trying to kill somebody who just says, God is my Lord? Not only is he experiencing the harshness of it, but he realizes nobody has his back. And he remembers an uncle that's not there. Or years after his wife passes away, and they are now bartering the freedom of prisoners of war, his daughter, who is married to someone who is taken into captivity, brings forth the necklace to be the provision through which she engages in the bartering, And it goes from her hand into a companion's hand, into the hand of the Prophet, and he recognizes the necklace of Khadija radiallahu ta'ala anha. And the tears, they just start to shed. Because sadness is not something that also is unreal. It's attached to the loss of something you love, right? And so when he sees it, and he remembers, the tears come again. He says, how did you get this? And they tell him, and he says, are you okay if we just give it back to her? And there's a lot that we can pull from this. But if any one of us is in a sphere or a frame where we believe, where someone has told us or taught us that to be human, which is essentially to be emotional, is to somehow be weak of faith, your prophet cried, man, when he was sad. And he felt sadness. Are you going to say that he was weak in his faith? Or he somehow demonstrated inadequacy or deficiency in his relationship with God? Or would you say that who he was represents what the ideal is for all of us? And if anything, his relationship with the divine was likely enhanced because of his ability to recognize his own emotions, and in turn, then recognize that other people had emotions too. Do you see what I'm saying? And so it's there and where we lie now in comparison to what I was saying before. You had in a dark age period, middle age period, moments where other communities were looking at emotional states as being demonic. Today, most of the rhetoric that you find is now shifting, I would say, because of the advent of things like live streaming and technology. I've been to parts of the world where all they really look to are Muslims from this part of the world, because where religion is corporatized elsewhere, governments fax out the Jummah khutbah, everything is very contained. They're not really talking about things like this. How do you address suicide as a reality? May Allah make things easy for us, right? How do you talk about abuse? How do you talk about things like just grief and anxiety? And where the conversations move forward, you're starting to see shifts in certain things, but there are still deep pockets that have kind of shifted where we look centuries ago and we have people who are building institutional apparatus through the Quran, which is telling us that, hey man, people get sad. Go do something to help them. Now a lot of the rhetoric is still rooted in, well, maybe you are experiencing something demonic. Everything is attached to jinns, right? And jinns are real. I'm not knocking it, right? Allah protect us from that. But to understand that that's not the only thing. Like, states of wellness are there, and we've shifted, and we see that those that were engaged in that type of pursuit are now the ones who are building out social services of all kinds, rooted in their faith traditions, that enable people to feel as if they're still entitled to a relationship with God because they are embraced and accepted, because there's nothing wrong with somebody if they have an emotional or mental wellness condition. And on the other end of it, we see institutional apparatus being built upon the foundations of things that a generation prior had laid for us, and we then take it to another level. Individually, you want to start to think for yourself why this is an important conversation. And it can be a little bit tough if you've never really talked about it before, but that's why most of you are probably sitting next to somebody that you know, because that's how we tend to sit. Or you are sitting next to somebody that you might not know so well, but I asked you all to introduce yourselves when we were here in the beginning, but now there's a lot more people. So, for a couple of minutes, given that we have more faces in the room, if you can just turn to the three or four people around you and tell them who you are, ask them how they're doing, get to know one another before we start talking to each other, and try to talk to some new people if you already know the people sitting around you. But let's do it again. If you did it when we did it the first time, when there was a little less of us, try to go and speak to somebody different. But just take 2 minutes really quick. everybody now. So, I want you to, maybe in groups of 2 to 4, definitely not like too much more than that, we're just going to talk to each other. We're going to talk about this idea of sadness, right? And we're going to go off the assumption that everything that I told you thus far is actually true and correct, right? Okay? So, even if you disagree with me, let's just pretend like you don't. And let's just say that's what it is, okay? The whole idea with this is for us to now not be in a place where we have to utilize religious text to justify the existence of a certain state of emotion, right? Like, do you really need religious text to be able to tell you that it's important to be kind, or to be generous, or to engage in volunteerism, or to ask people how they're doing, right? That's like a very surface level. And the legalistic framework that exists in our tradition is something that is imperative, it's necessary, right? This is a God-given mode of not just about recognizing how we get closer to God, but how we get closer to ourselves and in turn to God, and how we refine for ourselves a sense of spirituality that enables us to see this world in a way that actually gives to us meaning and understanding. So that we're not just going in this kind of mechanical mode of existence, but we find a deeper sense of purpose and a mode of ethical conduct that renders that inner fulfillment that a lot of us are longing for day to day. Does it make sense? So sadness is hard, especially in a place like New York City that can be super lonely. And it's that much harder when you're a Muslim in a place like New York City, which also can be super lonely. Because sometimes you're not the right race, or you're not the right culture, you're not the right gender, or you don't practice enough, or dress the right way, or look the right way, or speak the right way. Or you come to New York, which is a very transient city, and you don't have family or friends here, right? So the number of times we have people in our community who are really sick, and I gotta go with them at the very pinnacle of their sickness because they don't know what else to do because there's nobody else to take them to the doctor. Or people who we don't even know that they're like that. And not only are they going through physical illness, but also just emotional sadness because they realize at that moment just the loss of having those support. So our role here is to understand the duality of our involvement in this. One, I want to be able to pick up on recognizing where I'm at emotionally. And two, I want to be able to pick up on the people around me, where they're at emotionally. Because many of us, likely, if anything, we learned about love, like in a very weird way, right? We learned about things like being upset in a very strange way. So when we're sad, it comes out as anger. Or people just tell us, why are we so angry all the time? Or we don't know how to like relate to people who are going through things, right? Like we have a woman in our community who was in a physically abusive marriage for about 15 years of her life. And she got to a place where her sadness and her aloneness was so heavy. And then she felt aloneness in a way where she went into the shelter systems and found more theft and drugs and prostitution there than anything else. And then she had no resume or job skills because she got married in her teens and came from a different country and couldn't speak the language. And then she felt a different loneliness because she had to leave her kids with her abuser because she didn't have enough money to support herself, let alone anybody else. And then she felt really alone because somebody said, well, let me let her live with me. And then 3 days later was sitting in my office and said, that woman is just so weird. I bring people to my house as guests and she just sits in silence and sometimes just locks herself in her room and doesn't say a word. And when she comes out, she just doesn't look like she's okay. I said, man, this sister's lived in hell for most of her adult life. probably not been in a place of peace and stillness in so long, and she's just getting adjusted to it. But your discomfort with her is based in what? And you might say, well, is that the norm? And I would say that the problem with things like sadness, like many other emotional and mental states,